Like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection. Sorry about the late start, just trying to catch up with myself. And we're going to start out with a work session on House Bill 2815. So I'm going to open that work session. And up, I'd like to have Elizabeth Harchenko and Craig, since you're standing there, you might as well come too. But you don't have any place else to sit. And Victoria, can you give us a brief summary of the bill to remind the committee of this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2815 establishes the Interagency Compliance Network to enforce compliance with laws relating to taxation and employment among persons doing business on a cash basis and to ensure appropriate application of independent contractor status. It allows for information sharing among state agencies participating in the network. It creates the Interagency Compliance Network account with funds generated by increased fees for specified business filings and continuously appropriates money to participating agencies.
Thank you. And committee, for your information, as best I know, we had some issues in the bill, the language that we wanted to get fixed, that people had concerns about. We added, I believe, the State Landscape Contractors Board to this group and also put the Construction Contractors Board in line as one of the participating recipients of the Compliance Network account. And the blanks remain in this bill as to how much the fee will be increased and what percentage those are distributed to. So that's about the briefest summary I can give you of the Dash 1 amendment, and I'd like to let our panel just talk to the Dash 1s real quick and talk about the bill as it is now amended. So welcome to the committee, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue.
And Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the agencies that are identified in the bill as being drawn together as the network have been meeting and had an opportunity to meet with Representative Holvey last week to talk about the charge to the committee. And as you look at the Dash 1 amendments, what has changed there primarily is the way in which the charge to the network is described. The agencies felt that limiting the focus of behavior to classification of people as independent contractors might be too limiting. So you will see that there's some language that says misclassification of workers, including but not limited to the use of the independent contractor characterization. We're starting to see other ways in which people who should be treated as employees are being characterized other than using that independent contractor label. Clarifying that we've got five agencies, the departments of employment, workers, consumer business services, revenue, and the two licensing boards, construction contractors and landscape contractors, have a statute that we are tied to in common, but the Bureau of Labor and the Department of Justice are not tied to that statute. So a little bit of softening of the language. There was originally an admonition to adopt uniform rules, and that was going to be a problem for Bureau of Labor particularly. So that's been adjusted somewhat so that the agencies that have that common statute, we already have a statute that admonishes us to adopt common rules and administer consistently that statute that we share. That would continue. Bureau of Labor can come in now without any risk of having an inference drawn that they need to somehow change their organic statutes or the way that they behave with respect to their organic statutes. And so you'll see the primary changes are in that Section 1, the charge to the agencies. I've had a chance to visit with representatives of each of the agencies, and I think everybody is very comfortable with the language that we can deliver on that charge. Another thing that's been added is an explicit a direction to the agencies to report back to the legislature on what we're doing, how we're doing it, how we're using the resources, and what effect the work that we're doing is having, so that it's good to have that reporting back mechanism. We have worked together to try to develop a consolidated or joint financial statement of fiscal impact. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get it to the Legislative Fiscal Office until about noon today, so we haven't had time to really work through the financial issues. But the group, I think, is working consistently with what at least Representative Colby's been able to share with us is the goal for the work of the network, and the Dash 1 amendments move us, I think, in that direction very effectively.
And for the record, Craig Smith, I would echo Director Hrdzianko's comments. I don't have a lot to add other than I think I want to publicly thank Director Hrdzianko for her leadership and energy in this. It's been stellar, and we look forward to working on the Dash 2 amendments with her and for your review.
Thank you. Committee, are there any questions of this particular panel? Representative Wingard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that this is the aim of this bill and of the network is to concentrate on the construction industry. And if not, then I need to understand how broad the scope would be. Do you intend to go after anybody working in the cash economy? And if so, I see heads nodding. Why the need to have some of these folks then as part of the network if it's going to be more broadly, if it's going to have a more broad focus?
Well, Chair Hovey and Representative Wingard, I think that the answer is that the network would look at a broad spectrum. There may be additional industries that you want to look at for cash payments and inappropriate activity. Certainly, there's been some focus in the construction industry, and because that is the testimony, I think, that the committee got that prompted this policy, this is the reason why you would include Construction and Landscape Contractors Board. There may be a disproportionate number of folks in these industries that on the surface look like they may be somebody you want to look at. And as to whether or not you choose to put the Construction Contractors Board or Landscape Contractors in this group, of course that would be a policy issue.
And if I might add to that, Representative Wingard, just because I've been working with this for well over a year, this started out with the Construction Contractors Board and the Landscape Contractors Board actually being part of an independent contractor steering committee, and so this has sort of morphed out of that. Yeah. And the estimates of unreported income or misclassification of workers in the construction industry alone that we received indicated that it made up approximately 50% was the estimate of where this type of ill-reported income is at. And so and originally I didn't include the Construction Contractors Board in that funding mechanism, as you pointed out, but after review of especially the state of Washington's experience with this, the construction contractors or the construction industry seemed to be a well-deserved focus of this type of activity, and so it seemed that they definitely deserved this position to be able to do this work, because they were probably going to be engaged in it all the time. But notwithstanding that, there is a piece of this bill that is left for other agencies to participate that will be at the discretion of the participating agencies through a memorandum of understanding to bring other agencies or other industry agencies into this network as the group sees fit or as it necessitates. So it is actually it is able to be broader than just the construction industry. I hope that helps clarify that for you.
Mr. Chair, I really do appreciate that clarification. I guess I'm a little caught off guard because from the testimony earlier, and we heard this a few weeks ago, I take my share of responsibility for this, but it was my understanding what we were talking about was a compliance network that was designed to go after this particular issue, and I'm just now coming to realize that we're really giving this network compliance to go a lot of different places. We didn't take any testimony on that, and I'm just concerned. I'm comfortable, I guess what I'm saying, is with the idea of having this network focus on that industry, which you say makes up 50% of the issue. I'm uncomfortable about granting that authority it's broad authority, and I'm not sure everybody who might fall into this is fully aware of what we're about to do and really had the opportunity to come in and to either ask to be a part of it or to give input in one way or another. So that's the part that I'm seeing today that concerns me, is I'm just starting to realize that this network can really go anywhere, even outside of the construction industry. And I just don't feel like we have fully considered
But we did have testimony to that in the committee on other industries as well, from not only the division from the state of Washington, but also from somebody was talking about skimming in the restaurant industry, I believe, and the taxi industry, and there were several other industries that were mentioned. It just didn't seem correct to limit it, when in fact this is about compliance with employment and taxation laws, and certainly no matter what industry you're in, the people that compete in those industries should all be playing by the same rules and complying to the law, and so that's the charge of this group. So I hope that helps explain it to you. Representative Widener, question?
Please don't confuse us, Mr. Chair.
Funny, that's what he said, too.
I would never say that about my colleague. So, actually, agreeing with my colleague, this has gotten a lot broader than what I thought now that I'm going through this, and there's a lot of blanks in here that are not filled in on this bill as well. So, what are those percentages going to be when they come back? And there's a lot of things. I'd like a lot more information on this before I go any further.
Well, at that, we're not moving this bill today, and it's my intention to adopt the amendments so that the numbers can, which will help the fiscal to be developed, quite frankly. And it is not unusual to have blanks like this go on to ways and means to fill in or revenue to fill in when you have a subsequent referral. I hope that we're able to fill in those blanks here in this committee. Is currently my intent, but it may be that some of these blanks will end up going down to ways and means to either fill in or to change. So, Representative Krieger.
I'm not certain, Mr. Chair, how we figure out what it is you need to raise until you define what you're going to do, what's going to be covered, what's going to be encompassed. I don't know how you measure that, and I don't think revenue can do that. And then on page 5, 2, the Secretary shall collect a non-refundable fee of for each document. Well, I'm not certain. They tell you what the documents are, but I don't know how they would figure out what the revenue is going to come in until they apply a fee to it. Normally, committees get to look at the dollar figure on the fee, and based on the fee, that's how they make the determination.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be doing that in Ag here on the Department of Fish and Wildlife budget here, but we have the figures.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not certain how they do that, and like you said, there's all the blanks in Section 2 on that have to do with percent to the department, percent to employment department. And, of course,
right.
You can't fill those in until you know how much money you got.
Right, which is what we're working on and trying to get the fiscal out. But it's helpful, as you know, to have the amendment adopted so that that's a trigger to them that they need to do the fiscal on this. And so right now we don't have it. And that's why we're not moving the bill. But the policy involved in the bill will remain
the language that you see. I mean, the missing part is the blanks. And, you know, we have oftentimes moved bills to Ways and Means with blanks in them before. So it's not unusual. But I hope that we will fill the blanks in this committee in the next work session on this bill. So,
do you need a motion to approve the amendments, Mr. Chair?
I would hope that I could do that with so we can move this process along and get the fiscal that we need.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2815.
Representative Tomei moves the -1 amendments be adopted to House Bill 2815. Discussion? Representative Krieger.
Your last statement was you hope it will come back to this committee to fill in the blanks. Now, until they have a blank filled, they have nothing to calculate cost or calculate. So I don't know how they can give us a fiscal if they don't have a number to base the fiscal on. And I know that we need to put it in there.
Correct.
I just don't know where you
get
those numbers.
Well, we're in the process of the agencies are getting those fiscals to, are getting those dollar amounts worked up right now to get them down to fiscal. And so we'd like to have the bill in place so the next time it comes back.
We can adjust them if we felt we needed to.
We're going to talk about that too. But it's kind of hard to do what comes first, the chicken or the egg. So, sincerely, if there is enough discomfort with moving this forward, I suppose we could wait. It just makes the process a little more difficult.
Mr. Chair,
I'm not opposed.
Certainly.
If the director is going to furnish something through revenue, it would be nice if she let us know what she furnishes to revenue to do what.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's today, next week, and get it down there so when she has the numbers, they can get it and expedite the process. I understand that.
Yeah. Well, like I said, those numbers are going to come back to this committee. So any other discussion? Representative Wagner.
You keep saying hope. They're going to come back to this committee.
Well, ultimately, Ways and Means will make decisions. I could plug in any number I wanted to in this, but, they will get probably adjusted in Ways and Means. So, Representative Riley.
And we're not moving the bill. That's the key right now. We're moving, we're attaching an amendment. We have another opportunity to look at this before we decide to move the bill.
Yeah, that's all right.
Cindy, could I have a roll call vote on adopting the amendment?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Chair votes aye. The -1 amendments are adopted to House Bill 2815. Thank you very much for your help in getting me to this point. Let's see. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2815. Let's hope the next bill isn't quite as painful.
Don't bet on that.
Go with hope again.
So next up, we have a few manufactured housing bills. And I wanted to open up a couple of them at one time. I see Representative Klim is here. So I'm probably going to start with Representative Klim, even though I haven't figured out what bill I'm going to open up yet.
If I want to do all three of those, just like I was talking about them all if you want.
Yeah, that's what I'd like to do. So which? So I'd like to open a work session. On House Bill 2997, is that the one you want?
Yeah. Public hearing, you mean?
Yeah. Public hearing. Open a public hearing.
Oh, we're not moving them right now?
No, I guess not. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2997, 2998, and 3085. Okay. See if I hit the right ones.
3019.
And we'll open a public hearing on 3019 too.
Everything.
So we're now open under four bills: 2997, 2998, 3019, and 3085. Welcome, Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21 here in Salem, central and east portion of Salem. If I just take 1 second, since I'm in front of the Consumer Affairs Committee, I just got this email to my cell phone. I want to ask what your advice was. It says, fund release. We wish to notify you again that you were listed as a beneficiary to the total sum of 12 million British pounds in the last testament of the deceased. If I'd send them all my information, then they'll release my 12 million pounds. Basically yours, John Miles.
What's your best interest and concern, Representative Clem?
I'm not
you
allowed.
Should give him your bank account number ASAP.
Okay. Thank you. We're not allowed to give legal advice. We're the legislative branch of government.
Right, laws.
Representative, we'll talk later.
Okay.
So. Okay, back on track.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the eastern portion of my district, I have somewhere, depending on how they're doing, between 15 and 17 manufactured home parks, and one in particular had a real challenging situation that led me to draft 2997, 2998, and 3019. And I just thought I would tell you a little bit about it and what the bills do. There was a provision in law created a few sessions ago for a manufactured home park subdivision. And so what would happen is a park would turn the park into lots that then could be sold to the individuals who live there or maybe other people. And in the statute, they have to still remain for manufactured home parks. So it's a way of, you know, instead of just closing it and having it converted to another use, then maybe the folks could buy their own lot. And you know, so the bill got passed and it's begun to be implemented. And I think there's probably some more issues with that statute, having talked to folks who are involved with it, that may need to be revisited, like maybe the entire thing, possibly. But I can tell you about one portion of it. Out on Center Street, one of the residents came to me at a neighborhood association and told me kind of what had happened, and I went out and had a town hall with all the residents, and they, because they're not property owners yet, they didn't know that their mobile home park was being turned into a subdivision. So there's this whole process going down at City Council that they could have participated in to talk about what this would mean for them and maybe what conditions could be placed on it before it was approved by City Council. They had no idea because no notices went to them because they're not landowners. They're renters, technically, on the spot. So one of these fixes that. I forgot which one here. It's 2998. And I've been working with the coalition to get two of these bills in better shape than my skills plus legislative counsel's trying to follow my emails got them in. And so I think that, you know, there'll be some amendments. But this just basically says if this process of turning a manufactured home park into a subdivision, manufactured home subdivision, is going to occur, then the folks who live inside should get to know what's going on and participate in it by getting notice. The other one, because what basically happened here was the landlord didn't believe this was a park closure. I had to talk with the legislative council and convince him that it was. He was raising rents and telling people that they had to accept a certain price that he was not really willing to negotiate much on initially, at least, or move, or or you could continue to rent at this new higher rent I'm about to give you. And that none of that is lawful under the closure law. The closure law that was passed the last session says you got a year when your park is closed before they could increase rents, and a variety of tax credits and payments made available. None of this was explained to these folks because they didn't think it was a closure. I'm not sure he was even familiar with the law. And so we kind of got that part figured out a little bit, where then he started to understand he had to comply with this law. But most of these people are so frustrated that several of them have just moved. I drove through there yesterday. Their houses their manufactured homes are now for sale. They're paying rent or now in a mortgage somewhere else, and they're trying to sell these things because they got so frustrated with how this all happened. So I'm trying to come up with some solutions we can all live with to help deal with it. But I mean, they basically are going to take an enormous loss now because it's in the park. The park was in effect closed. Well, actually, in reality, closed. We've determined that it is, in fact, a closure to have your manufactured home park turned into a subdivision. The other bill is designed to, if you do stay and rent in one of these subdivisions, you don't buy the lot, but you stay and rent, that you don't lose the additional tenant right protections that we offer to manufactured home park residents. Because we have an extra set above and beyond what you would have if you were in an apartment. Like, you can't just be given 30 days notice to it's 90. And there's a variety of other ones. But because their park got turned into a subdivision, if we don't change anything, they'll just be treated like they lived in apartments under landlord-tenant law. And we've made a policy for a long time in Oregon that because you're in a park and you own of quite a large asset, you're not just a normal apartment person who can just move. You've got this major issue you got to deal with. And so this would help maintain the additional rent-to-right type protections that we've already given to folks who live inside parks to renters who stay in these subdivisions.
Mr. Chair.
And then the last bill I could describe after taking a question. If you
wanted to understand that one.
Yeah.
If you Representative Wingert, a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just help me understand what's going on when that converts to a subdivision. So
they're no longer a park.
But people can stay in their mobile home park on a lot that they haven't are they purchasing it and then just staying there as a mobile home while other people are buying empty lots and building homes?
Yeah, good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, what happens in, it could vary, but they have to stay manufactured home lots. So you couldn't just build a stick built on them. The way the subdivision law is written is the park can be closed and converted to a manufactured home subdivision only.
Okay.
So there's no incentive to do it in order to then, you know, build houses on it. It's still going to be a manufactured home park subdivision. But because it's no longer a park and now it's a subdivision, some people will buy and they'll now just live on the lot that they own with the manufactured home that they own. Some people are offered by that park owner, hey, I'll keep renting to you if you like. You know, you live now in a subdivision, I'll just go ahead and rent to you. And so there are several people in this particular park who are renting, and they do not have the same level of protections they had when it was considered a park.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Ripson Cohen.
Thank you. I'm having a little trouble following which bill we're talking about in these descriptions. So
sorry.
The specifics of... Okay, if we were talking about 3019, help me to...
That was 2997 is the one that talks about the...
Never mind, I won't ask my partner here.
I was lost then.
Okay, so 2997, then it does what?
This one, and it's written very strangely. So I would actually, for now, because there'll be amendments and John Van Landingham can describe what we're working on, I would maybe not pay too much attention to the words.
I'm not looking at the bill language. Okay. If you could tell me what the intention of it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Cowan. The intent is to have someone who continues to remain a renter in one of these subdivisions maintain the extra renter's rights that are afforded in state law to renters within a mobile home, a manufactured home park.
This last line.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. I hesitate to even get into this, but I understand what this is supposed to do. My question is, what if it's a new renter after it's been converted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, the way that, well, there's going to be amendments, so we could maybe deal with an amendment.
Yeah, just intent.
But I think the policy question involved is, if you are renting in a situation where you own the manufactured home, but you don't own the land under it, you should still, even if you're a new renter, be afforded the extra provisions that a park resident would have, because you can't just on 30 days deal with the fact that you're going to have to do something with your manufactured home.
That's where I wanted to
know. Can you just hit the last bill?
You betcha.
Sorry, and I got to see a lot of yellow badges on another bill, so I'll try and get out of here. Now, 3019, I don't think we're going to have the coalition be able to help us with, because I don't think they have agreement internally on that. So this is just me now. These folks who are selling, they've moved. Like one woman, Julie Apt, she moved over to West Salem and moved into a senior estates, and they bought a home, and now they're still trying to sell their existing home. They're going to have to sell for quite a loss here. And I said, you know, one option is you could get advantage of the tax credit and the payments from the landlord. And she said, we don't have anywhere to move to, and that's not enough. The moving costs are way higher than that. That's not enough. And so if they don't move under the law that we passed last session, if they don't move the manufactured home or they don't abandon it, I mean, she's trying to sell it, but just she's going to take quite a loss on it, then they're not eligible for the payment, for example. You have to abandon it or move. So what I was trying to do here was say, up to the amount of the loss she takes, but no more, she should still get the $5,000, $7,000, or $9,000 and the tax credit. So if she loses $30,000 because her mobile home park was closed, that up to the $5,000, $7,000, or $9,000, let's say she's got a triple wide. So the $9,000 payment by the landlord and the park owner and the tax credit, $14,000, should be extended to her. She's still going to take a $16,000 loss, but the subdivision process made it to where she basically feels that she can't move the unit at any reasonable cost at all. You know, she said $30,000, $40,000. So it's better in this case to just sell it for a $20,000 or $30,000 loss. But then she will get no relief under the bill we passed last session because she sold it and didn't abandon it or move it. So that's what I was going for. And I know the tight, times are tight. So I would even be fine if we took out the tax credit and just had the landlord payment. I don't know if some of the individuals with the yellow badges here are going to agree with me on that, but I just...
I don't think so.
Yeah, okay. I'm not hearing the other bill, I promise. So that's the three bills. Two of the three, I think you're going to be able to speak with the coalition about some amendments that I'd be supportive of that would help sort of make this a reality. The other one, I'd be happy to speak with you separately if you'd like to on it, but it's your pleasure, committee.
Thank you, Representative Clem. I see Representative Edwards is appeared in back, and we are open for House Bill 3085 currently, too. So if you'd like to come forward, and I don't know if Representative Clem has any comments to that bill either, but you're certainly welcome to get up and leave or stay if you like.
I won't be offended either way.
I want to watch Representative Edwards.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm state representative in House District 14, which is West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. In my district, I have 36 manufactured home parks, and so one can understand why manufactured home park issues are of particular importance to me. Last session, as many of you are aware, we passed a pretty substantial closure bill that set floors for protections for manufactured home park residents facing closure. As a part of that bill, we had a grandfather clause that grandfathered existing or soon to be existing local ordinances, and then there was statewide preemption beyond that. So there are a total, and I may, and folks can correct me if I get the specific jurisdictions wrong, but there are a total, I believe, of six ordinances that have protections at the local level that are above and beyond that of the state. That'd be Eugene, Bend, Wilsonville, I think Clackamas County, I think Oregon City, and I think Forest Grove. I think that's the six. There are some technical fixes that are needed in a lot of those local ordinances, but because we have statewide preemption, a lot of those technical fixes can't be made. And so House Bill 3085 would open up the preemption for a limited amount of time until this coming January 1st, and it would give time for those local ordinances to, or those local jurisdictions to adopt changes and fixes to make those ordinances work better at the local level, and then would close it back up, and preemption would remain. I will say that we need some amendments, because when I was talking with my staff this morning, I said, well, is there an emergency clause in this bill? Because if it only opens it up until January 1st, it needs to go into effect right away. And in fact, we found out there's not an emergency clause, so we need to have the bill amended, because otherwise it would open and close on the same day, that window during which ordinances could be amended. So that's the substance of the bill that I bring to you today, and the intent, my intent in bringing it to you, and I'm open for any questions.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this to our attention, Representative Edwards. Just to clear, I gather it is your intent essentially to allow those local jurisdictions to make only technical changes. Just in reading the bill, I'm wondering if we're opening up a can of worms for significant substantive changes. If not, I would lose much sleep over that. But that's a separate point. I'm just wondering, that's clearly not your intention, but I'm not seeing this in the bill.
Well, it's not, Mr. Chair, Representative Barton. The bill doesn't say what type
of
amendments could be made. So, now I have been told. There have been no advocates that have come to me and said we want to do something broad and expansive and radical in nature. I certainly can't speak to what local jurisdictions' intentions are. I can only say what has been forwarded to me as a reasoning that they feel like they need this. And so,
thank you, Representative. That's all the information I needed.
Thank you. Other questions, Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you be a little more specific about an example or two? Who can we expect to take advantage of this?
The city of Eugene would be
the principal.
I'm pretty sure that the city of Eugene would take advantage of it. I'm not sure which other jurisdictions would take advantage of it.
Quick follow-up, Mr.
Follow
Chair.
Up.
Are you comfortable with Representative Clem staying in the middle chair? Would you like him to move a little bit?
It's a rough balance.
Yeah.
Just, I wonder.
Yeah.
It's a center right panel.
Good point.
He's just
not from my view.
He's just from expressing concern from a consumer's position, probably. So I don't have any other questions for you right now. I appreciate your testimony. I really appreciate the issues, and I guess we'll talk about this some more and see if we can figure out if we're able to do something.
I appreciate your consideration and for getting this up here to testify quickly, because I got to head back to committee that I'm in right now. So. Thank you.
We're not stopping you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So next up, I'd like to have John Van Landingham, if I could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Brought you up by yourself, because you seem like you always come by yourself anyway.
there certainly are some people that I probably couldn't sit up here with. John Van Lanningham, Lane County Legal Aid, and I wanted to speak to all four bills, 2997, 2998, and 3019. The Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition met about 10 days ago to review those three. It supports 2997 and 2998. I'd be glad to answer questions, but I think that Representative Clem's advice is good. It would make more sense to wait and see the amendments before worrying about the wording. Representative Riley, for example, raised a question that I raised myself that the bill as drafted doesn't answer. And so I've made an offer. I met with Representative Clem earlier this week, made an offer to work with him and Legislative Council to try to make 2997 and 2998 do what he wants to do, which we agree ought to be done. So hopefully we could come back with those. 3019 is one that the coalition does not support, and that's partly because it messes with the tax credit. If you recall from last session, the benefits for displaced tenants in park closures are a landlord payment of 5, 7, and 9, and a refundable state tax credit. We're nervous about doing anything with any tax credit and for fear that it could be gone. And so I've given that feedback to Representative Clem, and that's part of the reason why we'd be concerned about even moving 3019. 3085 is one that I believe I can say that the landlords support, the park landlords and the park residents would support, at least the people that I work with. Representative Edwards is correct that there are six local governments that have those ordinances. I want to be clear, though, about what the bill actually would do. It would allow those local governments to amend up or down. Not just technical fixes. They could make substantive changes as it's written now. The only amendment that Representative Edwards is talking about is the effective date. There's a floor. The floor is the state law. Four of the six jurisdictions might want to amend down. In other words, reduce what they're currently providing, but not below what the state law provides, because that's the floor. You can't go below that. And the reason why those four might want to amend down are litigation. Bend, for example, has already settled a lawsuit by already amending its ordinance down below what it adopted, even though that violates 2735 from 2007. So this bill would allow Bend to lawfully do what it's already done. Wilsonville is here in the audience, and I'll let them speak for themselves if you call them up, but I believe that Wilsonville's ordinance is in litigation now. It lost at the trial court. It requires quite a bit more than 2735, the state law. Wilsonville appealed the trial court decision. That's at the Court of Appeals. It's already been argued before the Court of Appeals. We're awaiting that decision. If the Court of Appeals says to Wilsonville, you went too far, then Wilsonville may want to amend down its ordinance to provide still more than the state law, but enough to satisfy the Court of Appeals, if that makes sense. So the point is that as written, the bill would allow those six jurisdictions only to go up or down, or make technical fixes. But if you don't allow them to go down, then you're probably not helping four out of the six. I'd be glad to answer questions if you have any.
Perhaps I have one. So what is the, I understand the need for having a window to make these amendments. What is the downside to making that window longer or allowing these ordinances to be amended by the local jurisdictions when they need to?
Mr. Chair, that was an open window in terms of allowing any local government to amend its ordinance up or down, risks recreating the preemption argument, which almost caused me to die, but also, I believe, brought a lot of joy to you as chair of this committee 2 years ago. So the compromise that was negotiated on the Senate side, 2735 last time, was to allow those jurisdictions to be grandparented in, and that they could amend their ordinances through the end of the year, roughly, but nobody else. And they could only amend up. So that was the compromise on the Senate side. The combatants on the preemption issue were in the room here before you today. I would like not to get into that combat again. This is a minor amendment of that issue, and that's why the landlords can support it and why I think it's a good idea for you to do it.
No, thank you for that. And I wish you a long life.
I wish you hadn't asked me that question.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cowan, a question?
Well, with apologies for not having sat in this room through all of those discussions 2 years ago, or thankful that I didn't, either way, could you just very briefly tell me what you mean when you say amend up or amend down? I'm not that familiar with the ordinances.
Sorry. Representative Holy, Representative Cowan, by that I mean whether the city, it's five cities in one county, whether they would be able to amend their ordinance to increase tenant rights or amend their ordinance to decrease tenant rights, not below the state level. The state level is always there. Unless you amended that law, that's the floor. But those six jurisdictions have greater tenant protections than the state law. And the way the preemption compromise was cut in the 2007 session, again on the Senate side, was to say that they could amend up in the sense that they could only increase tenant protections. They couldn't amend their ordinance to decrease tenant protections. Now, I mean, that could be very simple. That could be very complicated. Wilsonville is the ordinance which has the strongest protections for tenants. Oregon City and Forest Grove adopted the Wilsonville ordinance, as did Bend. Bend has amended it because it got sued. And to settle the lawsuit, it took away all those strong protections and went back to the state law. Wilsonville might want to come down a little bit, too, if the court says, for example, you've gone too far, which is what the trial court said to Wilsonville. This is unconstitutional, two birds. So would Wilsonville want to require some benefits for tenants more than the state law, but less than what they're requiring now? Only if you pass this bill could Wilsonville amend its ordinance to do that.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you.
John, thank you very much for your work on this issue and appearing before our committee again. So we'll move on. Next up, I've got Don Miner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner, here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. We were the instigators of the park conversion law. Our goal in that original legislation, 2001 and 2003, was to allow a park owner who wanted to exit that business an alternative from closing the park and causing all the tenants to move. We wanted him to be able to sell the park to individual tenants. And we saw it as a win-win. The landlord could leave the business without upsetting his tenants, and tenants could acquire both the land under their home, refinance it, probably come out ahead financially. That was our goal. We developed that bill outside of the context of the coalition. And it probably would have been better served had we gone through the coalition, but they were working on other things. But more eyes on it probably would have answered a number of these questions. Our thinking on it was that if the tenants, we gave them the first right to buy the space that their home was on, and if they chose not to do it, that they could stay as a tenant. And we assumed the same rights as existed previous to the conversion. But that if another person comes in to buy the space, then they would be given a notice period and leave. And then with the new legislation from last session, they would be receive the $5,000, $7,000, $9,000. I think the coalition will come up with some language to make those ideas work a little better. The other bill that deals with the notice, I think it serves everyone's interest for the tenants to know at the earliest possible opportunity that this is going to occur, that the park is going to be converted. It allows them to think through the advantages and disadvantages. And so an early notification, I think, serves their interests well. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Question, Representative Riley.
So what you're saying is that these bills are basically doing what you thought you were doing in the first place?
Hopefully. Okay. Yes, I think they are. I think the language is a little bit difficult to work through as the bills came to you. But I think that the coalition is committed to coming up with solid language that will benefit tenants and not upset the original purpose of the bills.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. Next up, I'd like to hear from Earl Myrtle, and Greg Leo, and Linda Ludwig. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
My name is Earl F. Myrtue, M-Y-R-T-U-E.
I misread it. Excuse me.
I'm here in clients with Senior Park, and some residents in our park have lived there since in last year. It was the 20th year of our park becoming a. And now, 20 years later, these people that 20 years ago went into this park are well into their senior years. And many of the park tenants are widows. This last probably 4 months, we've had 3 deceases in our park and left 3 more widows. And these people are, I'm 80 years old, and many of the park residents are older than I am, and they're on a very fixed income. And in our park, in the last 5 years, right now the rent increase has been 18.5%. And that's above the consumer price index. And in other words, consumer price index is, this is our rent is quite a bit more. Most everybody in our park is on a fixed income. The widows have little left after rent with their small Social Security. A group of us came from Medford area in Jackson County, the southern part of Oregon, and the people live there because they love the area. With Ashland, with the festival there, Brit Festival in Jacksonville and whatnot, it's a lovely area. The little ladies in our park now are planting victory gardens. I don't know if any of you are old enough to know what victory gardens were, but as a child or youngster, I was raised in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we had a victory garden, and all the food was rationed, and so you had to live with it, and you had to learn to conserve. And today, with the price of food going to what it is, a little victory garden will help their food, help them with their food. But I don't know. I'm lost somewhere. But I went to buy some spaghetti a couple of days ago, and it's gone from 50 cents a pound to dollar a pound plus. And I don't see how or why, but anyway, that's the situation. And I hope I haven't rambled off too much, but there's a lot of people that need help today, and we recognize that throughout the nation. And I and some friends, we work with organizations to help the needy, and we distribute food whenever it's available. to the needy, and it's a pleasure to do it. And I'm getting old enough now, sometimes it's a little bit hard to get up in the morning and get out in this cold weather, but we get the job done, and the people appreciate it. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming up here and telling us. I think you made your point, you know, about the being on a fixed income, and it's not so easy, especially when your rent is going up by those amounts. I think you made your point quite eloquently, and I appreciate your testimonies.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. Just a couple of quick comments on House Bill 3085. The League does support this bill. We were involved last session in House Bill 2785. I believe that was the right number. Can't forget that. There are six jurisdictions that do have ordinances, and we believe the bill, as amended, would be helpful for those jurisdictions to allow them an opportunity for some amendments, realizing, again, that they will not be able to go below the floor that's currently set by state statute. We believe it would be beneficial to those six cities and or six five cities and county. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chairman Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Greg Leo, here for the City of Wilsonville. We were the first city to pass a mobile home park ordinance, and we were not part of the coalition process. Our city council saw the closing of the Thunderbird mobile home park and saw the very fragile population that was at risk. We took the initiative of passing the ordinance. The ordinance is now in court. We don't know when that court decision will come, but we think it should be fairly soon. We're here in support today of House Bill 3085. We think this is excellent legislation, which gives us flexibility to go back into our own ordinance to make any adjustments that the court might see fit. It would not be the intention of the City of Wilsonville or our council to decrease in any way the benefits that mobile home park residents would get. Our intention would be to keep it as close to the original ordinance as possible, but we don't know what the court will decide, and we're not going to guess. We're going to wait for the judgment. We're going to see what's necessary. And with the help of this bill and the excellent help of Representative Chris Edwards in offering this bill, we're able to then go in and modify the ordinance as the court might, you know, suggest that we do. So we do support House Bill 3085 today. We thank the committee for hearing the bill, and we're happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, and welcome back. I didn't know that we'd be talking about this subject again, but...
yes, we are.
Just a question about, you know, I don't really know which way your court case is going or exactly what the details of it are, but in fact, what happens if we pass 3085 and your court case actually doesn't end up getting settled in time for you to make that adjustment? What do we do then?
That is a concern, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Holvey, members of the committee, we didn't like preemption in the first place. We didn't think it was good public policy. We think that individual cities should have the authority to make ordinances which affect their citizens. You know, if this committee and this legislature decided to extend the deadline, I think that would be in everybody's best interest because it would give time to make those adjustments. There's a bill on the other side of the building that would get rid of this preemption completely. Preemption is generally not a good thing, we think, from a city government point of view. We didn't like preemption with mobile home park ordinances. If it were not here, then I think cities could tailor these ordinances to the specific conditions of those cities. But this was all debated out last session, and you hate to raise the issues of 2735 again. This body has spent a lot of time working on this legislation. We understand a deal has been made. We didn't like the deal. We weren't a party to the deal, but that's the way it is. So excuse me for the long answer, but if it were to be extended, we think that would be in the best interest of the cities and the people of Oregon.
Thank you. I mean, my question was really directed at your city because I think it's the only one that's involved in a lawsuit over our court litigation over this issue. And so I guess my concern is how do we allow you to adjust if you don't get it done by the window that we create in this bill? I guess that's a little bit of a concern I have in for the city of Wilsonville that I don't necessarily have for the other cities. So I just thought I'd throw that out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's hard to be first.
Yeah, and last.
Yeah, but we do think the committee, that the court will decide it fairly soon. I mean, the case has been argued and it's pending before the court, and we're hopeful that it will come out in due time to have the opportunity to make any adjustments according to the deadline of this bill. But were this deadline to be extended, it would be a good thing.
Thank you. Other questions? Not seen any. I really appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Peter Ferris.
Jim Jones, it was 2 years ago.
Good afternoon, Chair Holde and members of the Consumer Protection. I just have one brief comment to make. I think it's in regards to the tax credit, the refundable tax credit. I think it's quite ironic that the landlords would be arguing in this subdivision that they, that the folks would not, who could stay there, would actually be required or would not be able to get it. I mean, that's what the closure, that's what 2735 said that last year. And I think it's ironic because you, if you remember, Jerry Crumble was the one who championed that tax credit. It was a $10,000 tax credit to begin with. We opposed the tax credit from the get-go, and the reason why, we felt that the landlords should shoulder the responsibility of paying that, paying compensation, and not the taxpayers. And so that's been. Otherwise, I don't have any problem with the other bills.
Thank you. Questions? Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
So is that it for those?
Yes.
Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on 2997, 2998, 3019, or
3085?
Seeing none, I'm
going to... Lady in the back row, sir.
Oh.
There's a hand
please,
back there.
Please come on up.
Tell me which one. I'm having trouble tracking. I see you're not trying. I can't see your screen unless I want.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, for the record, my name is Kathy Cruz, and I live at Heritage Village Mobile Home Park in Beaverton. And I would just like to commend Mr. Leo for the courageous and trailblazing way in which he helped the city of Wilsonville to treat its vulnerable citizens with respect and dignity. He is truly a trailblazer. That's my only comment on this. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2997, 2998, 3019, and 3085.
There he is.
And I will open close the public hearing on those. I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3196.
Seems to be one of the...
Up first, I'll have Peter Ferris.
Good afternoon again. My name is Peter Ferris. I live in Bayview Mobile Home Park in Walport, Oregon. And I'm here today to talk about our rent control issue. I think that today you have a real opportunity to level the playing field in mobile home parks statewide. And I say that because We have a situation where most mobile home park residents do not have real consumer protection. None, often, and some of the time, but, and so let me explain the political reality of living in a mobile home park. Because the statutes favor the landlord, and because the statutes have very little penalty in terms of responsibilities of the park owner, and because the landlord can raise rents, he can raise rents with a 90-day notice as high as it gets, and because he has deep pockets, we have the reality on the ground is that most mobile home park residents live in fear, and they don't feel like they have a level playing field. I can't tell you how many times I've talked to people, and I've been working this issue for 5 years, who say to me, what's the use, Peter? Well, the use is the political reality. And what I'm suggesting is that you have this opportunity to level this playing field by enabling these residents to have a way in which they can adjudicate their concerns and issues with a park owner. And if they can do that, then they will be able to have some satisfaction that their issues are going to be, in fact, addressed. And so last year I had a bee in my bonnet about putting together, drafting this bill, and I spent a lot of time on it. I spent about 4 months on it. And so the bill itself, I think, is fair and honest, transparent, and I'm afraid to say that it does require new regulations. And I would say that, to follow my president of the United States, we need more regulation in this industry. There's no question about it. I am on the national board, MOA. I just got elected last year, and I can tell you that I know nationwide that this is a consistent problem. And I would suggest also, this is a problem that we bring to you every year, and you, every session. And you certainly are dutiful in handling these things, but at some point, I have the feeling that unless we remedy this situation, how can we, I mean, it seems we spent an inordinate time of your time trying to figure this all out. So, one comment about the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, because we've had a struggle with the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and I want to be really clear about it. I think they have done some good work in the past, but given the political reality, no park owner is going to ask for if consensus is the issue, and the consensus is the issue in the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, nothing is going to come out of that body that changes the status quo. That is fundamental. And so we see that time and time again. So what I'm going to do, first of all, I've given you a number of things here, but I first want to talk about the bill I've drafted, and I'm asking you to take a look at the description of House Bill 3196. I'm going to go through this quickly because I see that you're reading it anyway already. And
we do have a lot of people lined up to testify.
I know.
So
what I'm going to be another 4 or 5 minutes max. So it restricts increases in rent to CPI. It requires, there has a possibility of that the landlord is enabled to raise rents for infrastructure and then decrease them, close them down when it's paid for. It requires the landlord to meet with the tenants association, and here's the difference. What we're asking here is that when a tenants association is formed in a park, currently they're allowed to speak only on non-rent issues. And so what changes here is that we're saying all issues. And what this does is really empower the residents, and I'm saying this in a way that I demand that often when I talk to residents, you must form an association. Because what's the alternative? The alternative is doing nothing, which means, you know, they're not gonna get anywhere. So there's that, and they can go through mediation, but then in the end, if either party doesn't like where it's going, has still a grievance, they can go through binding arbitration. Now, this is paid for by a $6 fee that the landlords pay through per unit. And this is fair because we currently pay for a $6 fee for the mediation. So we pay for the mediation, they pay for the arbitration. It also requires OHCS to do a number of to collect information, which I think is important, because if you don't have regulation, or if you don't have information, how can you regulate these parks?
And by OHCS, we try not to use acronyms people listening.
Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Thank you.
And sorry about that, Chair Colby. And then finally, there is an appeal process, because we felt that sometimes a park owner, for whatever reason, may not think that he's getting a fair return. So there's an appeal process which the Oregon Housing and Community Services would again adjudicate. So the other thing that's there is some rent data. The other page, which is, I think, very compelling. Some rent data that we have presented with over the past 5 years, the CPI, Portland indexed, has been 11.2%. So when we began collecting this data, because we wanted to see what was actually happening in the state, there is no other data like this being collected anywhere that I know of in this state. So we've listed 19 parks here. And so each park, most of the parks are way above the 11.2, sometimes 2 and 3 times. And if you know about the multiplier effect, this is tremendous. So what we're suggesting is in the last 5 years, we have significant rent increases to the point where residents are self-evicting themselves. Self-evicting because they cannot pay it anymore. And so we have vacancies in parks. Heritage Valley, Heritage Village has 75 vacancies. It's a big park. But we are going to see that more and more. So this is a real concern. I've given you some analysis at the bottom on page 2. It's not quite clear to me why park owners are doing this at a time when people are really hurting. They're hurting because they're losing their jobs. They're hurting because prices are going up. And we have, of course, a very vulnerable population. So it's not clear to me why this is happening. In any case, I'm happy to answer any of your questions. I think I think this is going to make a big difference, and I appreciate anything you can do. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee for Mr. Ferris? I think you've given us a lot to chew on here with this bill, and I did look at it a bit ahead of time, and we do have a Dash 1 amendment. I know this issue is important to you and many others in the state, but we also have a lot of people signed up in opposition, and we have to listen to all the sides. So I appreciate
Certainly.
certainly appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Hovan. Thank you, committee.
So next up, I'd like to have Monica Sane.
Sayer. But I am a Sane.
Sorry.
No,
that's fine. Kathy Cruz and Dale Sargent. Mr. Sargent?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You signed up in favor of this bill. So I'm trying to keep the panels in favor and opposition separate, but we'll you can stay there and just, it's fine. So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Can I go first? You want me to go? I don't care.
I'll go. I'm fine. My name is Kathy Cruz, and I am a homeowner at Heritage Village Mobile Home Park in Beaverton. I come before you today to speak in favor of House Bill 3196, Rent Control for Manufactured Home Parks. In 2008, the unbundling of water sewer charges at Heritage Village effectively increased my rent by $75 in just over 1 year. My original rent at Heritage Village included payment for water and sewer. My current monthly payment, including rent plus water and sewer, is approximately $646. Although my original rent included water and sewer, the rent was never credited when the water and sewer charges were unbundled from the rent last year. Because of the lack of credit at the time of unbundling, I assert that I am now being double billed for water and sewer costs. In the short time that I've lived at Heritage Village, it's been about 4 years, we have lost services such as distribution of bark mulch to keep our properties neat and well-maintained, monthly yard waste pickup, and yearly pickup of large bulky items such as furniture, appliances, other household items, and construction debris. At one time, we also had a maintenance staff of 12 and security personnel who manned a booth at the entry to the park. Our maintenance staff has diminished by two-thirds, and we no longer have a security booth or any security guards at all. We're paying way more now than we were in the past, but our services have diminished greatly. Incidentally, when the water and sewer was unbundled from the rent, we received a letter from Cal-Am, who's the owner of our park, stating that you could either sign the new lease, which would in which you would agree to pay separately for water or sewer, or immediately begin paying a $100 a month increase in rent. And we consider this to have been coercive and ultimately punitive for people who didn't sign the new lease. Walking through the park, you can't help but notice unkempt yards, broken fences, and discarded washing machines, refrigerators, construction debris, furniture, and other items clogging carports. Because our monthly rates are so high, people cannot afford the cost to maintain their property or properly dispose of unused household items and debris. In addition, our streets and sidewalks have deteriorated to the point that some sidewalk edges have eroded dangerously or are cracked. Driveways are cracked, streets have potholes and clogged drains, curbs are crumbling in many places, and litter is strewn over the roadways and greenways. Our managers, although ethical and very, very well-intentioned, are understaffed to the point that they cannot take the time to enforce park rules. And this adds to our overall state of deterioration. By the way, I have a slew of photographs of deteriorated conditions. The entry to our park looks stellar. It's maintained beautifully. Once you get down inside the park, it's a large park, 450 spaces. It is in terrible condition. We have a high vacancy rate. Our monthly costs have forced many people to leave the park, in some cases just walking away from homes that they can no longer afford to keep. These are manufactured homes. They are not mobile homes. They can't be moved, or if they can, it's at a cost of something like $20,000. This has caused the park managers to allocate valuable maintenance man hours to refurbishing abandoned homes, which the park then owns, so that these homes can be sold by the park owner. As a consequence, routine maintenance has suffered. Additionally, our water and sewer infrastructure is crumbling since there has been no maintenance to the 30-year-old system other than to respond in an emergency manner to fix leaks and respond to instances of sewage backup into people's homes. The high monthly costs and eroding water sewer infrastructure work together to the point where people are forced to leave. Homeowners give up and walk away. Because the infrastructure continues to deteriorate, residents are justifiably concerned that their water and sewer charges will continue to go up, hence their rent will continue to go up. On the other hand, if you are a prospective buyer of one of Heritage Village's new homes offered by CalAm, you are offered a move-in special, which establishes your rent at only $395 a month for an initial period. Current homeowners paying close to $700 a month with the next rent increase are required to pick up the slack between the new buyer offer and the rent charge that the current homeowners are paying. This is in spite of the fact that two-thirds of our current homeowners are at poverty level or 195% of poverty level. Finally, the park owners will attempt to tell you that they think their rents are fair. And there are a lot of park owners represented here today. They cite statistics which include rents commanded for apartments in the area because they base their rents in large part on what is available for renters within a certain geographic area. But this is not an apples-to-apples comparison by any means. In apartment management, landlords are responsible for maintaining the buildings as well as the grounds. In mobile home parks, we own our homes. And in fact, many of us have invested thousands of dollars in improving our homes. The only property that we rent from the park owner is the small space on which our homes rest. A $700 per month payment for a small site in an unmaintained mobile home park is way too much for our homeowners to pay. Not only because of affordability issues, but also because we are clearly not getting what we're paying for. I invite any one of you to come and take a walk through the park with me, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. And it's shameful. In addition, the state of Oregon and its various counties have professed over the years a strong interest in preserving affordable housing for our vulnerable citizens. By instituting rent control for mobile home parks, we will be able to preserve one of our only sources of affordable housing for this group that we have in the state. Otherwise, the source of affordable housing will surely be lost. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. And I have a lot of people signed up. And so when you bring, if you have written testimony, don't read it to us. If you could summarize it, it would really help get more people able to testify. So because I do need to move this a little bit quicker to get everybody in if I can. So I appreciate that. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
All that work I did writing
it. Well, we'll be able to read it.
We have it now.
A copy of what I wrote in.
If you could just summarize your testimony.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and Consumers Protection Committee. My name is Monica Sayer, and I am coming from Buquest Park. It's a park that's 12 miles east of Medford. So, yeah, it's about 4.5-hour drive. Anyway, you're really putting in a tough spot with summarizing. Okay, you guys all got my letter.
Okay, read one paragraph. How's that?
One paragraph. I read fast. I can get going. And it's written big, you know. Well, I support the rent control. According to Chapter 90, Title 10, park owners are allowed to give rent increases every 90 days, no matter what amount. So be realistic. If your home mortgage company kept increasing your home, your house payments every 90 days, could you afford the payments? Could you afford to live in your home? Why single out manufactured home parks?
We are working class individuals who deserve a safe place to live without losing our homes to corporate greed. We live in an affordable housing community and should not be considered as a cheap or low-income housing. We put pride in our homes, too. And I can keep reading. It gets better. Even President Obama states the importance of affordable housing. And manufactured home parks should be included in this. We do not ask for extra funds to keep the parks going. All the homeowners are asking for is a positive attitude from the legislature to support Bill HB 3196, the bill for rent control. It is a simple solution to protect the manufactured homeowners from being priced out of their parks and to leave their homes because they no longer could afford their payments. It's not like they could give a 30-day notice. They can't even carry their house on their backs. It would cost a lot to move their home somewhere else. And elderly people are unable to pay for their medication because their park owners keep upping their space rent. People are walking away from their homes. People are getting laid off. The economy is in crisis. Everyone lives on a budget. People are fighting for their jobs and their homes. There's your realistic picture of people trying to survive. And we need rent control to keep everyone involved in perspective. It should not be about greed and more profits. It should be about survival. So please support the HB 3195. And thank you very much for letting me read it all. I snuck it in there. I told you I read fast.
Thank you.
So any questions? I'm willing to answer it.
I think your testimony was self-explanatory, and I appreciate you traveling all the way up here to let us know how you feel about it.
Thank you.
So I'm going to move on. If you want to go ahead and take your place, and I'll invite a couple more people back up. And Mr. Sargent, you can stay right there. You can stay right there, Mr. Sargent. And you can go ahead and start as soon as I call up Adam Cook and Wayne Hildebrandt. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yeah, I'm Dale Sargent. I manage a manufactured home park in Canby, Oregon. I'm not really prepared to do this. I didn't come for that purpose.
Oh, you didn't come to speak?
No, I did not.
Oh, okay. Well,
thank you.
You can just sit there.
Kind of like us.
If you'd like to introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes. Good afternoon, Representative Holby and committee members. My name is Adam Cook. I work for a company that manages manufactured home communities. I actually prepared my testimony today in writing. I planned on reading it to you, but I'll try to summarize for you as best I can. The company I work for manages manufactured home communities in Oregon and Washington. We are one of the largest fee management companies in the country, and we have very conscientious clients, and my family happens to own four communities in Oregon as well. I've also been a member of MHCO, which is the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, for the past 10 years. Our industry continues to face more regulation all the time, and we struggle to find investors for our industry when regulation increases because it makes it more difficult to conduct business. And it's all kind of spelled out in my cover letter, but I would like to basically emphasize a couple important things, and if I could just read a couple paragraphs that emphasize that. Not all of our communities are created equal, and therefore we aren't always comparing apples to apples. Some communities offer more amenities and have greater curb appeal than others. There is an additional cost to provide these services, and typically this is reflected in the amount of rent that is charged to the tenants, but not always. Each community attracts its own tenants who feel that the community they select is the best choice for their housing dollars. As has always been the case, a landlord and tenant have the opportunity to come together where a tenant gains full knowledge of the rent to be charged, including a 5-year rent history, which is required by law to be given, as well as the aesthetics, amenities, and condition of the community. This allows the tenant to make a fully informed decision before entering into a written contract after considering all of the housing choices that are available. No one forces them to do so, and as a result, there continue to be buyers for homes in our communities because it is affordable housing and a good value. This has worked very well and doesn't require the government to set price controls on our business. at this point in time, we need additional incentives for landlords and developers to build communities. Right now, you don't see a huge rush of, well, you don't see a huge rush in development at all right now, but there's not a bunch of landlords looking to develop communities right now. It's because it doesn't pencil to build them because it's not as lucrative as they might have you believe. There's a very limited, conscientious clients that we have that work hard to operate their communities and only give increases as necessary to cover their costs. And we would appreciate it if you would consider not moving this this bill forward. Thank you.
If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Wayne Hiltebrand. I have a park here in Salem. This bill, I am against this bill, of course, and I see this bill hurting as much as it helps, because most of the parks in this state charge a reasonable rent, and they don't try to gouge the residents of their park. And as my companion here says, there's quality of parks vary widely. My park is kind of a Motel 6 of parks. It's a nice and clean, very clean place to live. We don't offer a lot of amenities. I look at my rents every year, and I generally raise the rents about every 2 years as needed. I don't try to gouge anybody. And the way I see this, if you pass a bill that gives us guidelines that we must not exceed, I probably will take those guidelines and take it to the limit every time, because then I'm going to wonder when they're going to ask for a freeze. And so I never reach the limits, I don't think, that this bill spells out. I rarely do that. And I think most of the parks in this state probably do not. So you're probably going to hurt as many people as you help if you pass this bill. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Going to try to keep the questions to a minimum unless you have something that really needs to be answered. I've got a lot of people that are left to testify.
I can wait till later. I'm sure there's lots more landlords out there.
Well, go ahead, Representative Widener.
Just real quick, because you were talking about developing new manufactured home parks, and I'm wondering if it's probably our land use restrictions that have probably hurt us more than anything for developing these parks and causing the rents to have to be as high as they are. Would that be a safe bet to...
Representative Widener, you're right on the money. With the land use that we have now, you cannot go out in the country or anywhere and build a park. You have to build it inside the urban growth boundary. When you get inside the urban growth boundary, you are limited to land that's in there, and it's very expensive land. And therefore, when you go to build a mobile home park, a manufactured home park, you're going to get about 6 homes to the acre, maybe 7. You can put hundreds of units on an acre if you want to. So you're right on.
Yeah.
The ground becomes too expensive to put 7 units to the acre on, or 6.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And actually, that's a different bill and a different committee. So... appreciate your testimony, and Mr. Sargent, thank you for your contribution too.
Thank you. At least you have a gavel.
Next up, I'd like to have Chuck Carpenter and Troy Rost. Rost. I just had him up. See, he was here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To move things along here, I've submitted some
light reading for you and the committee, and I won't read it to you. I'll trust that you'll take the time to do it if you're so inclined. My name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm executive director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and we represent about 500 manufactured home communities in the state of Oregon. And I'd just like to make some comments to you this afternoon regarding Senate Bill or House Bill 3196. Obviously, the association and its membership are opposed to this piece of legislation. I just want to clarify a few things to the committee. First of all, I do not think, and I think most of the folks here representing landlords and landlords across the state of Oregon feel that that they have all the rights and that the residents have no rights. This is a constant struggle that we always go through every session, and we will for the foreseeable future, and that you have one person's major asset on top of another person's piece of property. So we have tried over the last 10 years that I've been executive director to try to work out those issues through the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and I think we've passed through that negotiation process. We've found a balance between resident rights and landlord rights. And we as landlords do recognize that the residents are our clients, they're our customers. We need to treat them with respect. We have an obligation to provide them with quality living environment, and in return there is a rent that they have to pay. And that rent is reasonable. It is the lowest rent in the state of Oregon. And I'll get to that later. But with the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, that is where we try to work out these differences between the landlord rights and the resident rights. We've passed significant legislation that I think my membership would say that is very biased towards the resident. Things like subsequent sale, mandatory training, rent disclosure, 5-year rent disclosure, mediation, park closure. All those are things that we have compromised over the last 10 years to give to residents to level the playing field. And we are committed to this legislature and the future legislatures to continue to work and meet residents' needs, but also to meet the needs of the landlords. A couple points I'd like to make here on 3196 before you guys go any further here, before the committee goes any further. One of the things I'd like to point out to the committee is that those who provide manufactured housing communities as a housing option are the largest private providers of affordable housing in the state of Oregon. And if you were to pass 3196 and say that you can only charge so much for rent, you're going to do two things. First, you're going to drive out good housing. You're going to force landlords to cut back on their maintenance and to consider park closure. And I think you'll exasperate the park closure problem once we get back into a stable economic situation. So that'll be the first thing that'll happen with if you pass 3196. I think the other thing that will happen here, and I think we had some previous testimony on this, is that we have many, many members, many, many landlords in the state who do not raise their rent every year. And I've had, I think you've probably got 10 different letters from manufactured home community owners in the state before you. They are not here to testify, so you can breathe a sigh of relief on that. But if you read those letters, you will see that many of these people raise their rent every so often, but not every year. Sometimes it's every other year. Sometimes it's $8 one year, no rent increase the next year, and then maybe $4 the next year. There are letters testifying to that. And I think that tends to be what owners of communities do here in the state of Oregon. It's not a guaranteed thing that they're going to raise the rent. But if you do pass 3196, I think what you will see in the state is that landlords will raise the maximum amount every year, because there's always the chance that their expenses may exceed that amount in the years to come, and they'll never have the ability to go back and to raise that amount. So you will damage the supply of affordable housing by passing this bill, and you're also going to damage it by forcing rents to go up. And the last point I'd like to make to you is that we realize that when a park closure happens, that it is an extremely emotional issue. People are losing their homes or having to change their housing option. But the second biggest issue in that park closure is where do we put people? that amount of rent that they were paying, the $344 in Eugene or the $350 in Portland, there is no housing alternative that is less expensive or as affordable as manufactured housing communities. So if there is a problem with rent as perceived by 3196, then where is that problem? Because I don't see it when we get involved in park closures. And we have had, as you all know, have had a number of them over the past 5 or 6 years. And when that happens, when those parks close, there's no place for folks to go for the amount of money that they're paying. That is where the real crisis is. It is not that rents are going up or that rents are too high. It is that when that housing alternative is no longer available and people have to move on for whatever reason, there is no place for them to go that is as affordable. Regardless of the quality of the housing, as we said, there's all kinds of options in terms of the manufactured housing communities, but there is no place for these people to go for that amount of rent. And therefore, if there is no place for them to go, what are we doing that is so terrible that is allowed to have, we've provided this housing? So if there's a problem, I don't see what where that is, especially when we get into park closures and we have to look at other housing options. So I ask that this committee not go any further with 3196, that you realize that we are the largest private providers of affordable housing, and for the most part, 95% of these parks are well-run. They're quality organizations. We have the Landlord-Tenant Coalition to work out our differences, and I think over the years we've done our best as landlords and as residents to meet reasonable compromises. So I urge you to not go any further with House Bill 3196. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Question, please?
Representative Riley.
Thank you. And thank you for your testimony. I understand exactly what you're saying, and I look at the rents that are being charged, and of course these rents are not everything that the tenants have to pay. They also have to pay their mortgages on their actual home. But still, it's a pretty good deal. So we don't have a big problem with most of the people in the state, and that's what usually happens with when we have something that we have to deal with. Like, you know, what do we do about the few? What do we do about the 58% increase? And, you know, what do we do about that? That's my problem.
Well, Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, first of all, you have a commitment from myself and from my organization, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, that we do try to discourage outrageous rent increases, that we do realize that we have a customer base and we need to meet the needs of that customer base. For antitrust reasons, I am limited to what I can do on that.
Yes.
But we do, our overall philosophy is to provide quality housing at a reasonable price and to try to discourage that. When I do get the phone call from people that, you know, say they want to raise their rent $50, you know, my typical response is, what the heck are you doing? You want to be on the front page of the Oregonian? And that tends to calm things down. But for antitrust reasons, I am somewhat limited. I would also say that, you know, 10 years ago, I did serve in this body, and you know, there's 5% in every industry that we seem to struggle with, and it becomes very frustrating that we gear our legislation toward the 5% that are screwing up. And we don't think about the 95% that are providing a quality service, whether it's in manufactured housing or other products, other industries, other services. And it's very, very frustrating. I unfortunately don't have an exact answer for you, but I can assure you that we will try to the best of our ability discourage outrageous rent increases.
Well,
go ahead.
I just finished a work group on another subject, and we actually, what we tried to do was take care of that 5% problem and make sure that we solve that problem without hurting the other 95%. And I think, you know, all the people who walked out of that room said, we did it. And I would like to see this happen with this. I don't know if it can or if it will, but I'd like to see that happen.
Representative Chair and Representative Riley, we come back to the Landlord-Tenant Coalition. I think one of the reasons why we have stayed with the Landlord-Tenant Coalition over the last 15 years, and believe me, there have been times it's been pretty ugly, and my board has been very, very reluctant to continue with that coalition, is the belief that probably the best way to resolve these issues is through that face-to-face negotiation between resident representatives and landlords, and to foster a better understanding of what each side faces in running this business. So we will try to, through that mechanism, try to reach that 5% that sometimes seems unreachable.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Representative Lincoln.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, it's a little bit broad, but as long as we're talking about the issue of affordable housing, what do you believe that we could do from a policy perspective that would make it easier, that would help this affordable housing problem, that would make it easier for people to open more parks, that would provide more of this lower-cost housing in and around Oregon communities?
Chair Riley, President Wingard, that's an excellent question, and that's something we're very, very interested in pursuing. Certainly land use is a large part of that. Other aspects of this would be system development charges and just the general regulatory environment. To provide this service, this housing option, at a reasonable price. I mean, we have folks who are very interested in building new manufactured home communities in the state of Oregon, but because of land use, the price of the land, value of the land, the existing development charges and things like that, they're discouraged. And I would add that if something like this bill were to pass, any possibility of that happening would be negated. We met with Representative Buckley, one of the sponsors of this piece of legislation, and he asked pretty much the same question on Friday. What do we need to do? When are we going to have new communities built in the state of Oregon? Well, and the first step to that is, if this passes, you'll never see a new community built in the state of Oregon. So it's just general regulation, real land use, and those sort of things that are contributing to this environment of not wanting to build manufactured home communities. Do you have anything you want to add on that?
Sure.
No.
Thank you.
So, your testimony, please. Or?
My name is Troy Brost, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm the owner of Sombrick Manufactured Home Community in Eugene. I'm currently the president of MHCO, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. And I give you a little package there. The term rent control comes in various forms. I'm opposed to House Bill 3196, and I'll give you a brief personal and fiscal analysis. In terms of the different forms, often it's called rent justification. Currently, Senate Bill 929, I refer to that as rent control, too. That's also called submetering of water. I believe rent control is emotionally charged and fiscally irresponsible. Based on emotion and rooted in value, however, the consumer always, in my opinion, to answer your question, Mr. Riley, the consumer always dictates the price in a free market society, and it's value that's the key operative, in my opinion. Communities that do offer value enjoy stable management, great occupancy levels, and vice versa. And I don't believe House Bill 3196 will create either, because price is not value. Rent control guarantees strife. Great manufactured home communities are two-way streets, and I've given you some information. I believe consumers are responsible to make informed decisions, and I also believe that landlords are responsible to provide accurate information on park living. What I've given, I'm not sure everybody has a package and it make enough, but I've given you some documents here. These are required by current statutes. There's 31 pages of information that I'm required to give prospects prior to signing their, 31 pages of my documents prior to signing a lease or rental agreement. That's exclusive of marketing material, of course. So, that being said, removing the emotional part, There's a fiscal part that needs to be analyzed, and I'm going to present to you something that's very unique, possibly you've never heard before, and I'll only speak numerically regarding two scenarios, and it's comparing where a consumer owns their land versus leasing their land. And this analysis is of a high-end manufactured home community versus a high-end subdivision. The numbers, however, hold true for lower valued communities as well. They've been reviewed, the numbers, by MHCO, by my accountant, and it's been published in the 1995 issue of the Allen Letter, written by George Allen, a national housing consultant for manufactured housing. It's a two-part document. The front's a verbal analysis, and the back's a verbal analysis. The inside is a financial analysis. I know you'll need to get your glasses or magnifying glasses, or glass, I do. It's small, but it fits. There's a bunch of considerations regarding the lifestyle that has to be considered, including who maintains the common areas, the community center, the pool, the restroom facilities, who pays the natural gas bills, the taxes, and so on. And if you own your land, another question to consider in this type of a community is how much are your monthly dues and fees? So nothing's really free. The other question is, what are these items financially worth, and how much will they increase? Is a 5,500 square foot bare piece of land, is it truly worth $75,000 in Eugene? So those items alone, they're not the full picture and the advantages that I've spelled out here on the land lease lifestyle. Financially speaking, the average total hard cost that you'll see is $63,000 less in a land lease community versus land ownership. Upfront costs for finance packages average $22,000 more in a subdivision than where you own your land. On page 3, it compares owning versus leasing and land scenarios over a 30-year period. And it also, the calculations reflect a 3% annual inflation, sometimes referred to as CPI. And also adjustments to taxes, fees, appreciation of rent. The real estate taxes versus personal property taxes over this 30-year period, as an example, is $68,000 savings in land lease. And $75,000 not spent on land in a AAA-insured tax-free municipal bond at 5% current going rates is a $32,000 investment, $324,000 investment over a 30-year period. That investment alone covers the 3% annual inflation increase to rents. So if you finance your home and place it on leased land, you could save anywhere between $45,000 and $81,000 under this scenario over a 30-year period. If you pay your home in full and place it on leased land, you may save approximately $145,000 in the same 30-year period. So I believe House Bill 3196 is unfair. Landlords and homeowners are team members, and they cannot exist exclusively of one another. In my community, rents are analyzed annually. This year, I imposed a $6 rent increase. That was 1.18%. That'll take effect in June. Homeowners enjoy their lifestyle and appreciating home values, and county tax receipts increase as well. That's what happens in my community. The marketplace sees and experiences value, that key operative word in the lifestyle that I offer. In my opinion, it's a triple win. So I ask you to not support House Bill 3196. I believe it's un-American, unconstitutional, and instead, I'd request that you support the frontline efforts of the statewide manufactured housing landlord-tenant coalition. So I'd like to thank you for your attention and time to this serious matter.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, even though I missed part of yours.
You've got it in writing.
I've got it in writing, so I appreciate that. Thank you. I'm going to call up the next witnesses. I've got Rich Delaney, who traveled from some distance, and also Jack Sicking. I apologize if I butcher these names. And Misty Fisher.
And certainly, if you have written testimony, please hand it in and summarize for us. And if something's already been said, please try not to say it again, because we got a lot of people still signed up. So I'm going to have to try to keep you to 2 minutes apiece if I could at this point.
It's not a problem.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, members of the committee, group here. I'm Richard Delaney. I'm West Coast Mobile Home Parks. I'm a real estate broker. I manage mobile home parks. I've been doing this since 1980. I operate in 7 western states. Oregon is a big market for me. This is an important issue, and obviously I think it's wrong. I put a letter in. What I've heard today that I think is worth comment, there are 2 points. Obviously, rent control is an emotional issue. But as a real estate broker, I see both sides of it. You know, nobody wants to say somebody shouldn't have enough to eat. Nobody wants to say somebody shouldn't have enough to do this. Yet the people I work for are just like the people who are up here. They have fixed sets of payments. They're people, too. They have mortgages. They have utility expenses that are going up. They have things that are beyond their control. I have one woman who's a widow trying to raise a kid, and it's tough for her, but she's a park owner. I think the other thing I would say is mobile home living is a choice, but this bill seems to say that all of the problems with mobile home living are the park owner's responsibility. And I think that if there is an economic need or if there is a hardship, certainly it is not the park owner's responsibility. And that's my statement. You have a complete letter if you want the details.
Thank you.
I guess I'm next.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Jack Sicking. I own 2 mobile home parks. I'd like to say hello to the chair, to the vice chair, and to the people up on the diocese. I own a mobile home park in 2 of them, both one in Clackamas County, unincorporated Clackamas County, and the other one in unincorporated Clackamas County. I took a look at the... I was surprised when I saw this. I was on vacation, and when I came back, this had developed. Reading through it, there are things in here that are really disastrous for a manager or owner-manager. I'm the manager and the owner of my parks. And here it says, cost of capital improvements may only be recovered in equal monthly amounts, and the recovery period must be at least one half of the estimated useful life of the improvement. Well, I year before last, I had to repave my streets in a park over in Boren. It's a beautiful park. It cost me $55,000. I took my estimates over to the bank, my local banker, and he refused to give me any money. So then I had to go to another bank. I went to the other bank, and they said, yeah, we'll give you $50,000 to it. You have to put up $5,000. It did. And they said, you have to pay it back to us in 5 years, monthly. Well, actually, that road should last for 15 years, perhaps 20 years. Now, if I cannot go back to my tenants and say, you have to help me pay this, but you have 20 years to pay it back, all of a sudden, I don't have the money to pay back the bank. And then I'm in bad shape. It's draconian to think that someone could put in a major improvement like that and not get back the money in a reasonable amount of time, as according to the bank. And by the way, the U.S. government has a 5-year rule also. They also allow you to spread it over 13 years, or they allow you to do it in 1 year. Well, I did it in 1 year, and I got a lot of money back in my income tax. I was very happy. So I took that money and went to my other park and did the same thing, except for one thing. The park that I live in is an old park, and there were only half the amounts of streets. The full bid came in for that smaller park last year at $55,000 also. Well, I only had $43,000, so I wasn't able to do the whole job. But I did take that, and I did the whole job. Now there's part of the job that's not done. If I can't go back to my tenants and say, you've got to replenish this fund so that in case there's another emergency or there's something else that has to be done, how am I going to pay for it? I'm not going to pay for it. I won't be able to do it. It won't be done. The results of this type of thing, from people that don't know the business or know what they're doing, is that the mobile home parks, my mobile home parks that I love the people in the mobile home parks, they're going to go to rack and ruin. And so what you're going to have is, instead of a mobile home park, you're going to have a bunch of trailer parks and a bunch of bad looking places, bad places to be. That's what's at stake here. This is not a community type of thing. This is a something that people are looking to reduce the rents at without having the facts. And that is the facts. There's a couple of other things too. The community, this section 3B, the Housing Community Services Department shall impose a civil penalty on the landlord in the amount of $1,000 for each violation of the provisions of this subsection. $1,000? That's excessive. $1,000 for what? If the landlord does not pay the fine within 30 days after the department determines that a violation described in this subsection occurred, and it's going to put on a $100 per day bump on this $1,000 that I can't afford to pay in the first place. I mean, it's something out of Dracula's scorebook or something of that nature. I really don't. It's not a laughable thing.
Well, I think you've made your point.
Yeah.
I'd like to get some more testimony in. If you could sum up,
Just the word.
I take it you're opposed to the bill.
Yeah, and I'll end it by saying, let's get the whole thing, and we'll go like this.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're free. I appreciate that. Just so anybody that's waiting for what bill do we have left? 2255. We're not going to work that bill today. We're still waiting on fiscals on that. So. I don't know if anybody would be waiting around for that, but if they are, they don't need to. So, thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Misty Fisher, and I didn't want to testify. I'm Mr.
Oh,
Mark
okay.
Fox.
You're opposed to the bill, though, huh? So, I appreciate you signed up, so that's why I called you up. You know, if anybody signed up and didn't want to testify when I call your name, just say, I don't want to testify, and that's just fine. So,
right.
You save yourself a trip up. Thank you. Next up, I've got Jimmy Figueroa, maybe, and he doesn't want to testify. Okay.
We got it.
Okay, yeah, you signed up opposed. So.
A show of hands.
Steve.
I'm not kidding.
Steve. Galantine?
Oh, God, it's not that good.
Jerry, you're scaring people. Like,
jeez.
Even if they're not going to testify, they're scared to death.
A brave soul. Norton Cable? Leon Ehod?
I don't want to testify.
All right. More of those.
Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Steve Galantine, and I am a resident manager of a property. I have been in the business for 35 years, and I oppose this bill because I've been in states where there has been a rent control ordinance in certain areas, and I've been in places where there isn't. And I think that one thing should be brought out here that I'd like to say is that this bill is really not necessary because this is really a self-leveling system to start with. If you're a entrepreneur and business owner, you're not going to put yourself out of business. And you can by raising rents to a point that people cannot afford it. And virtually you can put yourself out of business. If it's not a product that people want, they won't buy it. And so why do we need a written mandate in something that automatically manages itself? If there's no market, there's no money. And so the people that would raise the rents to the point to where they would have so many foreclosures that the park is not profitable, that's just bad business. I don't think you've seen it happen that many times. And again, I'll reiterate what has already been said, is if you do not allow a person who owns a business to have enough profit to be profitable, he cannot maintain the property, and you will have, instead of manufactured home communities, trailer parks. I happen to manage a very nice community. We have a river that runs through it. We have garages. The homes are on 5,000 and 6,000 square foot lots. They are all double wides, 27 feet wide, various lengths. We're complimented all the time on how the community looks. It's a very desirable place to live. We're on a dead end road. We are some of the higher rents in the area, and for every person that complains about a rent raise, whatever that may be, they have the option to go to another park that may be more affordable. We offer prices in homes also that are greatly gapped. We do cover the full spectrum for people. We have one park that is, I'm just going to pull a number, say $500 a month for space rent. We have another park that is $300 a month for space rent. The ones in the $500 park, of course, is much more beautiful, much more desirable, and so that covers one class of person. We have the $300 space park. You can buy a home in that park for $1,000. We are providing affordable housing, and I'm against this bill.
Thank you. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Representative Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Norton Cabell. I'm the legislative director for Oregon Rental Housing Association. We also are a trade group that represents park owners and managers. I'll be very brief, and I apologize. I got the name of the committee wrong on my testimony. Please, mea culpa, mea culpa. Oregon, like many states, struggles to have sufficient affordable housing. Parks are an important component of an affordable housing supply. They also provide a rarity, which is owner-occupied affordable housing. And I'm a supporter of affordable housing. My wife is the treasurer of St. Vincent de Paul Society of Lane County, a large affordable housing provider in Eugene. In our own rental business, we specialize in renting to a very poor segment of the population. I chair the Housing Policy Board, an intergovernmental board comprising Eugene, Springfield, and Lane County, whose mission is to increase the availability of decent, affordable housing. The object of this bill is to preserve affordable housing. But the overwhelming majority of economists, including Nobel laureates Milton Friedman on the right and Gunnar Myrdal on the left, agree that rent control doesn't work. Massachusetts repealed rent control a decade ago, it not helping that the mayor of Cambridge lived in a rent-controlled apartment. Rent control is on its way out in New York, hastened by Congressman Charles Rangel, who lives in one rent-controlled unit and his office is in another. While in the short run, individual renters can benefit from rent control, in the long run, distortions in the market arise, routine maintenance and necessary improvements get deferred, and corruption becomes inevitable. Rent control is an overly simplistic solution to a complex problem. Rent control of parks would lead to deterioration of existing parks, hasten the closure of those parks, and reduce to zero the likelihood of developing new parks. I encourage you to vote no on House Bill 3196. Thank you.
Thank you for your concise and to-the-point testimony. I appreciate you making the effort to come up. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. Take a quick stab at this. This is about manufactured parks, and it's pitting owners against renters. But the bigger picture, and I think everybody in this room agrees, what can we do about more affordable housing, whether it's in this or not? Where would you start? I know it's complex, but where would you start? I know you wouldn't start with rent control, but where would you start?
So, Representative Gilliam, Representative Holvey, members of the committee, that's a discussion that would take a whole lot longer than you and I have today. Price
different
of land.
Different bill, different committee.
Different. I think I don't feel qualified to answer the question, so I guess I'd prefer to defer.
Thank you.
He had it on the front here. Representative Gilliam.
That's what threw me off.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony.
I'm on both.
Next up, I'd like to have William O'Arney, George Dietrich, Tom Jarmer. It doesn't matter. Just sit down and introduce yourself for the record. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm George Dietrich. We own three mobile home parks in the state, approximately 450 spaces. I'm not going to add anything more. We're against this for quite a few of the number of reasons that are already been specified. I will read you a paragraph from a letter we just sent. To a resident of Creekside, which is one of our parks in Hillsboro, as you're probably aware, this is normally the time of the year when a rental adjustment letter is sent to all residents to become effective July 1st. We wanted to inform you that you will enjoy the benefit of no increase in rent at this time, as the park owner has decided to postpone this year's adjustment in view of the current economic conditions. And it goes on to thank them. But if we were facing rent controls, this would have been at least the CPI and above, because we don't know when we would get the next one. And so all the people would suffer, when in this case no one's going to suffer. So everybody gets this, the equivalent of their, the thing that's coming down where they've adjusted their income tax. So that's approximately what our rent increases have been in the past. So $10 a month.
Thank you.
That's it.
Chairman Holvey and members of the committee, I'm opposed to this bill. Obviously, I'm also a manufactured home community owner. I own approximately four communities.
You identify yourself.
I'm sorry. My name's Tom Jarmer. I'm a manufactured home community owner. I have given written testimony that in a packet that Chuck has presented to the committee, and so I won't go on too long. I just, one of the things I want to say too is that I feel bad if there is some residents where there is excessive, unfortunately there is excessive rent increases. As Representative Riley had said, you know, it amounts, I don't think it's even 5%. I bet the reality of it is 1% or 2% of all community owners. And more than likely, they are large corporations that are trying to justify this to shareholders. But that's not the majority of the community owners in this state. The majority of the community owners are people like myself or small businessmen. They're mom-and-pop communities. My average rents have increased over the last 10 years about 2% a year over the last 10 years. My last rent increase letters I sent out last year, I did not have one resident of all my communities that called me or submitted anything opposing, because they understand that my expenses do increase too. My property tax went up, my insurance went up, my water and sewer to city municipalities, they also went up. And I also And lastly, stating is if this does go through, the development of manufactured home communities will go to zero because there's nobody that's going to want to go out and invest the money that we spend in our communities and then have somebody be able to tell us what and how we're able to raise our rents. They're going to move on. They're going to move into something that does not have rent control. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, too. I appreciate your testimony. Next up, I'd like to have...
Fritz.
Fritz.
That was a mistake.
Okay.
But I opposed her.
Thank you.
I want to go on record. Let me see.
Carolyn Shaw.
Well, then you have to.
I signed by mistake. I don't want to testify.
And Johnny Shaw, same thing?
Yeah, I won't go for that. But I'm opposed.
Stephen Alicia.
But you're for it.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's opposed. Thank you. That's everybody that has signed up to testify has testified.
Could I make a quick statement, Mr. Chair? If you would indulge me.
We're not in work session, Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're the kindest chair in this building. Since we have a lot of landlords here, and they're probably, for the most part, good landlords, we passed a bullying bill that affects children in school, but we haven't done it to the landlord-tenant community. So if you could take care of the bad landlords that are out there with bullying, it's still legal, and you can exercise your rights still at this time.
Mr. Chair.
Now you can bully me some more, Chair Holby.
I did have one person that wanted to testify again, and I don't normally allow people to testify twice.
I know. I kind of wanted to ask you, too, if I could make a quick comment, actually.
Go ahead. Come on up.
Actually,
and you sit down, please, and identify yourself for the record again.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm Monica Sayer, and I am from View Coast Park down in Medford area. What I kind of wanted to say was I'm listening to all the landlords talking, and it isn't, I kind of feel like I really should be turning around and talking to them.
You are.
Yeah.
Does it matter?
You're talking to the
okay. I think the part that bothers me the most is that there are some really good landlords. I know from being vice president of our Buquest Park Tenant Association, I actually went and I did a survey on almost 40, well, there was about 44 parks I went through in Jackson County alone. And if you look up in the word, the personal taxes are in there, they actually list 162 parks in Jackson County alone. These are all manufactured home parks. And the reason I got into all this here was because our park alone, we had $95 worth of increases within 13 months' time. And it's a big increase. Now, our park owner chose to do that, and because there is no rent control, you're stuck paying that because there's no law. You cannot, there's nothing to support you. The law says it's okay. Did you get your 90-day notice? Yes, you did, and it's done. So you are stuck paying for that. Now, with the survey that I did, there are some awesome landlords, and I've heard some here, too, that talk today. They chose not to give the increases. So, unfortunately, this bill, I think, has a... It's sad that it has to come to that, even that it, you know, you're trying to get the bill in here being heard. And why? It's because of those landlords that are having the problem of, like, with our park. Why $95 in a year? Why not just, you know, if they pick a percentage or just said, okay, even if it was $10 a year, nobody would squawk and scream and complain. But it's because we did get $95 a year. It is a huge increase. And we just had another up again, another $30. So now we're going from, I literally went from 302 and now I'm paying 425. And this is like in such a short amount of time. You know, and so that's the part that concerns me. It's not the good landlords that are trying to help. It's those that chose to go the...
Thank you.
Did I make it clear? I don't know.
Yeah, we got it.
Got it.
Thank you
for listening to me, Ken.
Kathy Cruz was actually the person who signed up wanted to testify again. So
I'm sorry, and I beat her. No problem.
Can you do it in just a minute? We were supposed to.
1 minute.
We were supposed to be out of here 3 minutes ago.
So. I'll be even shorter.
Thank you.
Kathy Cruz, Beaverton, Oregon. I would like to focus to the crux of the issue here. My belief, and this is similar to what was just said, Mr. Chair, representatives, my belief is that there are several what we might call rogue landlords who are making giving the entire industry within Oregon a bad name, and these landlords are not even operating. They're headquartered in Southern California for the most part. And so I guess what I would do is implore, you know, we keep coming back to these rooms and these chambers, and it's driven by the rogue landlords. I would implore everybody in this room, including the group of responsible landlords who are here today and this committee, to try to figure out a way to deal with problems that are caused by the rogue landlords that make tenants suffer, homeowners actually suffer, and also give the industry within Oregon a bad name. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3196. Committee, we are carrying over House Bill 2815 to Friday and carrying over House Bill 2255 to Friday. And along with that, we have House Bill 2369 and 2371 and 2189 on Friday. Thank you, committee. And with that, I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Good morning. Representative Brown.